This is the fifth lecture of the 17th ACC, March the 1st, 1957. This is a lecture about problems they're handling and running. Easily the most important process in Scientology is problems of comparable magnitudes. It has no peers. We don't care how low a process runs or how high it runs. Sometimes we have pre-clears that can run lower than the processes we are running. Sometimes there must be no effect on me postulate can outvote many of our efforts against them. But nowhere in Scientology do we have, or in Dianetics, did we have, a process which ran as high and as low as problems of comparable magnitude. Now that is the process with the widest span. Now that idea of span should be clearly understood bio. It's a process that runs both high and low. Now there are processes which undoubtedly run lower than problems of comparable magnitude, and there are processes which run higher than problems of comparable magnitude. This was certain, you see. But no other process runs both so low and so high. The only thing necessary in a problem of comparable magnitude for an action to take place is for the terminal selected to be real to the preclear. It's the only condition demanded of problems of comparable magnitude. That the terminal selected must be real to the preclear. Now that is a necessary condition for the running of it. And is that question which an auditor asks concerning the type of process which he is going to select, is it real to the preclear? Well, in this particular case, problems of comparable magnitude become real only if the terminal or terminals selected become real. If these are real, then the preclear can undoubtedly conceive a problem concerning that term. That's the first condition. And where this process breaks down, and where it is apparently unworkable, it is actually not being run. Since problems of comparable magnitude, by definition, is a process which brings the preclear to invent situations of similar importance to a given situation. And the given situation must be composed of one or more terminals. Therefore, two thetans banging around the universe do not make a legitimate subject for problems of comparable magnitude. They are not terminals. Thus, sickness is not a legitimate subject for problems of comparable magnitude. Sickness is not a terminal. Now, what do we mean by terminal? It would be any fixed mass utilized in a communication system. That, I think, is the best of the various definitions that have come up for this. Any mass used in a fixed position in any communications system. Thus, you see, a man would be a terminal, but a post could also be a terminal. Thus, a man's head could be a terminal, but so could a hat, because a hat could also have fixed position. But between the two, we get a hat as questionable. It's only questionable to the degree that it has less mass and is easily shed. So that somewhere along the line, there is a border between a terminal and a condition. Now, we have to know what a condition is. A condition is a circumstance regarding the mass or terminal. A condition is a circumstance. Therefore, when you're asking problems of comparable magnitude, if you run them on conditions, you are calling for a circumstance or a problem comparable to a circumstance which doesn't have any fixed position and never did have any fixed position and never did operate in any communication system. So you're describing a description. And there's nothing into which the preclear can get his long, sharp teeth. And as a consequence, you don't get much progress. Now, sometimes you can run an apparent condition as a problem of comparable magnitude to condition and get away with it. Something does happen to the preclear. But that only happens because he involves a terminal in his answer. He's making the process work. Now, apparently, then, we'll have many cases whereby we are asking for a problem of comparable magnitude to sickness, you see, a circumstance. What is sickness? You see, something has to be sick. Sickness is the circumstance. The something that is sick is what the auditor wants to use. You can say a problem of comparable magnitude to a sick dog. Truth of the matter is, you've described it a little bit too much right there. You should just have a problem of comparable magnitude to a dog, and you would get much more workable results. You see, you don't add too many conditions to this. Now, dog is condition enough. What is a dog? A dog is a mass which has meaning and mobility. And why add more meaning and mobility when you're trying to get at the mass called a dog? Now, once in a while it works, then the problem of comparable magnitude to sickness does seem to have a therapeutic result on the preclear. Now, why does it have a therapeutic result if I say that running problems of comparable magnitude to a condition doesn't produce good results? That's because the second that you say problem of comparable magnitude to a sickness, the preclear conceives some sort of mass that is sick. And although he hasn't articulated, he is running a terminal, a mass, a thing, something which has changeable or temporarily fixed location in space. All right. Now, first we must conceive, then, the difference between a condition and a terminal. That's quite important for you to conceive. If you can't conceive the difference between a condition and a terminal, why, you're in for it. This technique will forever be beyond your grasp. And that's a very easy thing to conceive, however. The light is on. Now, on is a circumstance regarding the light. So you wouldn't run a problem of comparable magnitude to on. But you would run a problem of comparable magnitude to light. See that? It sounds idiotic, but a lot of people miss this one. All right, let's take this now and see that there are masses, and all masses are only relatively fixed. Some stay in one place for a long time, some stay in one place only for a millisecond. But masses are masses, and they are not, by the way, particles, unless you consider particles as a subdivisible singular. Masses are something that are shed from a thetan by markup, and particles are something that are shed from masses. That's usually the way we find these things. It's quite amusing. You don't run particles. You wouldn't say problem of comparable magnitude to the air molecules in this room. These things are random, confused, confusing, they're shifting in space all the time, and they have very little relative mass. So we wouldn't say problems of comparable magnitude to radiation. Once more, we would have a bog on the part of the preclear. We wouldn't get much out of this process. Mass is shed and you get particles. So what we mean as a terminal has a relatively fixed, identifiable, isolatable location in space. It has a mass which is identifiable, is locatable, it does exist somewhere in space. Now, if we're running something, a problem magnitude to a ridge, we're getting indefinite, but we could conceive a ridge or part of a bank or a mental image picture to have actual location in space and mass. We could consider the thing such a terminal. But we're stretching it a little bit when we do that. But we can run that sort of thing. It's got to have mass. It's got to have relatively fixed position. It's identifiable. It is a thing. You understand? It is a thing. Now, the particles which the U.S. government is gratuitously giving back to the citizenry, radiation, are not fixed. They're not identifiable. You can't see them. You don't know if they're there. They're not there. And the unknownness in this is so tremendous that a creek bear gets pretty well wound up. When we realize that these particles were not a mock-up originally, but were something that shedded from a mock-up. They leaked. They came off of a mock-up. We realized that by running the original mock-up and deleting that from the bank, that we no longer have a foundation for the particles to impinge upon. And we have done our job. Now, just why you don't run particles, just why you don't run problems of comparable magnitude to words, just why you don't run problems of comparable magnitude to conditions of one kind or another, is best demonstrated by your running it sometime. And that's a happy adventure for the auditor, not the preclear. Auditor says, well, let's make a test out of this, see if Ron's right. It's always a good thing to check me up. Always a good thing to do, very wise thing to do. You want to spend all your time doing that. Don't spend any time auditing. We get such a thing as a preclear that feels down in the mouth. That's fine. It's a good cliche. So we say to the preclear, now give me a problem of comparable magnitude to being down in the mouth. Obvious use of the technique. And then just watch him go through the floor and pass out and repeater technique himself back down the track. And all kinds of odd things will happen. Well, now, the only way you could get away with that is if he considered that the problem of comparable magnitude was to him a terminal, namely a body, which had a certain condition. He runs a problem of comparable magnitude to his body, or his body feeling bad, but he's dominantly talking about his body. So you could get away with that one occasionally. To make a real surefire test, you should run something like this. A problem of comparable magnitude to fancy words. Now, that's indefinite, not... And it's up in the air enough, and could shoot the bottom out from your preclear fast enough to suit it. Almost anybody, even a California auditor. Now, here we have then a technique which, like all techniques, has limitations on the auditor. The auditor, to run this successfully, must choose, first and foremost, a terminal as his target on a condition. Now, the next thing the auditor must do is to choose the right terminal or terminals. You must choose the right ones. If he does these two things well, then he has started well. And he can produce considerable results. But now he has to run it in a particular form and fashion, which, if he understands a lot of it, again, he might as well have just skipped the whole thing and gone off and had the pre-clear play pat a kick with a wall. Pre-clear get further along than with Fromm's complement magnitude improperly run. And he must understand the procedure of running this technique. Now, you wonder why I am stressing this. Well, almost every time that I coach anybody on this, I find out he's got a curve on it. I find out there's something wrong with the way he's running it. The most fabulous thing, this technique can go off the rails faster in auditing than any other technique I know anything about. Now, one of the things that is most remarkable about it is that auditors do not accept from the pre-clear. They don't accept from the pre-clear problems. Most auditors don't like problems. They're obsessively solving them all if they're having any trouble with their auditing. In other words, an auditor is obsessively solving problems and can't stand the idea of a problem anywhere in the world, has no business auditing. And he certainly would have an awful time running this technique because he has to accept from the pre-clear a problem every time the pre-clear answers the question. So this is why I suppose an auditor is so unchoosy in running this when he runs it wrong. Now, the way to run it wrong is this. Now, give me a problem complement. We'll say that he's chosen a terminal. We'll say that he's uttering the question properly. We'll say his procedure is good up to this point. And he says, well, now give me a problem comparable magnitude to your mother. And the pre-clear says, well, the Atlantic Ocean. And the auditor says, good. Now give me another problem of comparable magnitude to your mother. Well, what's wrong with that? Well, the Atlantic Ocean isn't a problem. The pre-clear has not articulated a problem, and we get this oddity about it. Pre-clears, when they start out on this, almost invariably go through this sequence of answer. They give you an object, a comparable object. Then they give you a condition as their second answer. And only then will they give you a problem. Actually, it requires about three answers. Now, he said, any problem comparable magnitude to your mother? The fellow said, Victor said, the Atlantic Ocean. All right, now if the auditor said, the proper auditing phrase, how could that be a problem to you? Get this oddity, the preacher would say, well, the Atlantic Ocean overflowing its banks. Now, an auditor who can't stand problems will still accept this one as a problem, but it's a condition. See, the first thing he did, pre-clear gave, a comparable, what he conceived to be a comparable terminal, and then he gave a condition. And only on another repetition of how could that be a problem to you would it come home to him. That there was a problem involved with it. How could that be a problem to you? So the auditing commands are, give me a problem of comparable magnitude to a terminal. How could that be a problem to you? And early in auditing it, how could that be a problem to you? And if necessary, how could that be a problem to him? Or as many times as necessary to get the pre-clear to finally dredge up the problem. Unless the pre-clear can get that idea of a problem, the technique is unworkable. But what is the technique? Problem of comparable magnitude. It's a problem that is being asked for. Now, the semantics of the thing may throw him. Therefore, the command could be cleared with some profit.
I asked Brinkley one day, I said, we don't seem to be getting very far with this. Let's clear this command again. The command is, give me a problem of comparable magnitude. Now, let's take up this word problem. What is a problem? You know what that Brinkley told me? He said, a problem is an unsolvable situation. Open and shut case. He even gave me an example where the teacher said to the school children, all those who are having problems with their arithmetic should remain after class to get it explained. And for some reason or other, this person ever since had always then therefore considered that problems were unsolvable by definition. The problem was something you could not solve. In view of the fact that this person considered herself, by the way, girl, a person considered herself a problem, she, of course, was an unsolvable case. And the whole case just kind of fell to pieces on the clearing of the command. We got the semantics of this thing beaten out a little bit, and the person all of a sudden did a funny cognition and said, well, see, I've always been a problem to my family, and I helped her along a little bit. Always been a problem to my family, and by the way, this discussion and the clearing of the command didn't produce any results for about 48 hours. I mean, this was a slow haul. There was an aftermath on this particular case. Person's problem to her family, therefore she was unsolvable, so therefore an auditor auditing this person could not, of course, solve the case. Quite interesting, quite fascinating. But that means that anything in life that became a problem to this preclear meant that it was beyond recall, could not be touched, and so forth. In view of the fact life is made up with problems, this preclear was totally unable to cope with any part of it, because all problems were unsolvable. So clearing the command, of course, could be of some use. It was a misdefinition of the word to end all misdefinitions. But more important, perhaps, even in the definition of the word, which in itself would possibly tend to fall apart after the question had been answered quite a bit, the idea of comparable, which means associative magnitude, almost never requires any explanation. You can define it as an English word, and you can say the same order of magnitude, as big as small as, the same size as, something like this. This doesn't seem to upset them a bit. They can run this off, I think this is our general experience, they can grasp this rather easily, and yet those are the formidable words in the command. So let's look at this rather closely and see that it's a sleeper there. The word that is liable to throw the command is problem, not comparable magnitude. And because those are polysyllabic, you're liable to believe that on some preclears, comparable magnitude is where they will hang up. And this is not where they hang up. They can wrap themselves around this one. I've never had to shift the command from comparable magnitude, which is quite interesting. I've never had to shift it. I've wanted to taxi drivers and mechanics and people in the lower end of London and so on. They think that's a swell pair of words. I've had them say that to me. They understand what it means, though. All right. The auditing of it must include another thing, and that is a feeling on the part of the preclear of himself figuring on it. That's evidently a necessary part of the running.
I'll give you an example.
We say, we clear the command. We say, problem call magnitude to your mother. Brickler says, the Atlantic Ocean. We say, how could that be a problem to him? Brickler says, overflowing his banks. And you say, all right, how could that be a problem to him? And he says, I could figure out some way to keep it from over its banks.
If you're not sure yet, because you wouldn't be sure with that one, you would say, but how could that be a problem to you? Or, alternate command here, can you get yourself figuring how to do that? Get the idea of yourself figuring how to keep it from overflowing its banks?
Yeah, I can get that. That's fine. That's what you want. He's got to get an idea of himself figuring it out. And that's what you mean when you say, how could that be a problem to you? You want that included in the anatomy of the running of it. Now, this is getting to be a pretty complicated looking process, isn't it, huh? You didn't know there was always this process. Well, don't lose heart. An HCA student the other day, and we're getting some mighty fine HCA students, no doubt about that. Some of these people are being turned down on HCA level. I'm very, very proud of them. These HCA students, however, are banging into this head-on, first time and brand new, and sometimes they run for a few hours on a tech date before the instructor catches them. So I heard one HCA student busily pushing another HCA student out the bottom with this auditing command, which is a classic. I mean, this is a classic. No doubt about it. Give me a problem of comparable magnitude to the axioms of Scientology. Well, I didn't know what the auditing command was. I had gone to inspect some work in the building, and I found this pair auditing. And while I was inspecting this work, I noticed that that preclear was not behaving right. The preclear was being foggy, sort of dazed. Comm lags were long. He was taking things up in an uncertain fashion with his auditor. And I knew some command was being run which disobeyed these fundamental rules of problems comp magnitude. So I went over and asked the auditor about it. And the auditor gave me that classic response. She said, but he is having trouble learning his axioms. So obviously, we run problems comparable magnitude to the axioms of Scientology. Look, the poor guy's already having trouble with all his postulates. And now we throw him into the soup to this degree. We simply make him run every postulate of importance he has made on the whole track all at once. With no terminals of any kind. Well, he's pretty skookum preclear. He was actually alive after a couple of hours of this. Well, I told her about a terminal. And I told her that if he was having trouble with learning the axioms, the fault was probably with books. That's a terminal. Or perhaps with a teacher. More importantly, a terminal, more closely in communication with a thetan, because the teacher's live. A person is usually in better communication with live objects than dead ones. And explained this to her, and explained this business about how could that be a problem to you. She was getting that all right, except he never got that far. In other words, she was perfectly prepared, she assured me, to say, how could that be a problem to you, but I don't think he had gotten up to a point where she could ask it yet after about 2 hours. All-time championship barrier been erected there. Now, I told her to level it out, perhaps, or at least give him a slight win. You see, you find a blunder of that character, just don't drop it and then leave him anchored on the track with a big lose like this. I said, get a problem of incomparable magnitude to the axioms. And after he answers that one rather easily, change off to a problem of comparable magnitude to a textbook or a problem of comparable magnitude to a teacher. Could have explained to her too, but I didn't, that he obviously, possibly in grade school, had a teacher that he fisticuffed with and with whom he was on the opposite sides of the fence of. They were not friends. And problem of comparable magnitude to that person would have changed the learning rate of the pre-clear. That's for sure. It's as easy as that. Here she had her hands on something that could have been a powerhouse, and yet she looked at the condition and followed up like that. Now, an alternate auditing command to all this is incomparable magnitude, as I just mentioned. When you tackle something so huge, so formidable, that it'd mean a couple-hour comm lag on the part of your prickler, see, he's just this moment been informed that he is going to be electrocuted at dawn. Just this moment been so informed, you see. And you want to desensitize and blow him out of his head and leave him a dead body, which would be a good joke. Nothing on this order, you just didn't want it. You realize that this problem could be so huge, so overpowering, so tremendous, that he would never be able to see around even one corner of it. He's totally fixated on this. His fixation is unbelievably great. His fixation upon it is practically physiological. He is straining at this thing. There is no horizon beyond this. This fills the entire sky. It goes from horizon to horizon and down to the very center of the earth and fills the entire universe on the other side. And that's how big this problem is. Now, it came from a crack that John Sanborn made. And he thought he was being funny. He thought he was being funny. It was just a wise crack. And he said something about, how about the problems of incomparable magnitude in his usual dry way? I wondered whether or not you couldn't run data. So I got a datum. Tried to get somebody to get a datum of comparable magnitude to space. Space. The space of this universe is certainly an awfully space, you know. It is. And there it is. Person couldn't get it, strangely enough. Just couldn't think of another postulate or another activity or another isness which matched up the space of this universe. I don't know, it was terrible remissness on the part of this person. He obviously was slipping that day or had a headache or something and didn't manage it, so I shifted gears over to a problem of incomparable magnitude to space. And had the pre-clear give me, after about less than 20 questions, a problem of comparable magnitude to space. He got a datum of comparable magnitude to space. He actually did get what to him was a datum of comparable magnitude, and then got several more. And then it was very peculiar that he had no difficulty getting out his own anchor points. Space is an only one sort of thing. The space of this universe simply is. Now, this technique of incomparable magnitude enters in at the bottom on problems. If a person can't get a datum of comparable magnitude, or the problem, just by your listening to him, appears so huge, overpowering, why, what do you suppose? What do you suppose that you should do? Get a problem of incomparable magnitude. And at the top end, a preacher who's in excellent condition, is handling life very well, but is still not able to mock up a universe this big or something of the sort, you can always run data of incomparable magnitude to any datum in Scientology, any axiom, anything we've ever mentioned. You can get a datum of incomparable magnitude to it and find him getting a second datum. Now, things get stuck because of the only one. I told you that yesterday. You have to get something of comparison to it before you can find out how big it is or how small it is. You cannot evaluate on a single datum except by postulate. And if you must evaluate by demonstration, then you can't do it on one item. If you require a demonstration to know how important things are or are not, then you require a second datum by which to evaluate it. You see that? Of course, you yourself should be in a condition whereby you simply say that is important or that isn't important, and that could then be the evaluation of any single datum. Therefore, a single datum could not worry you if you're in the condition of being yourself on your own determinism, always capable of defining it. But you wouldn't think like a man. You would not think. The rationale of some very convincing politician down here would pass you by utterly. You would reach at once to the truth of the matter that he's a jerk. He's being totally illogical, and his whole argument must be motivated by a pitch. In other words, your idea of logic would be a laugh. The logicalness of things, or the progressive order of the things, would not be beyond your power to arrange, or would certainly not be necessary to your ability to live. In other words, by no experience would you be evaluating anything. You would simply be saying, it is or it isn't. Today I will have good luck. Today I think I'll have bad luck. This is a beautiful woman. Same woman. This is an ugly woman. Same woman. This is a very passionate woman. Same woman. This is a very frigid dame. Same woman. Funny part of it is, if you were up in the ability to do that, she would be beautiful, ugly, passionate, frigid, hungry, or well fed. But you certainly would not be the effect of the game, and you wouldn't have much of a game. So your idea of games, your idea of the necessity of problems, that sort of thing, would also have to be altered before you could simply pronounce the value of things. You would no longer be human. You're aware of the fact, by the way, that you cannot be human and be right. That is not possible. There is no such thing as being human and be right. I've mentioned that before. But here is a very definite result of being so wrong, is that one requires two data to know the value of one. And that is the first and foremost symptom of all logicians. A logician is a second-rate magician. Now, here we have, then, a necessity to have evaluation by others. evaluating by other things, evaluation from other people. One dresses up to the nines and must be told that he looks well. Looks well in accordance with what? Well, he looks well compared to Joe. See? A person just wouldn't look well. A person would look well in comparison to how he looked yesterday. That's another fellow yesterday. And one of the reasons people get their banks in re-stimulation all the way up and down the line is simply they are comparing each successive moment to the terminals in yester moments. And in doing that, they have admitted that no other terminals exist anywhere. As soon as they believe no other terminals exist anywhere, they get into this game of comparing all present self with all past self. And therefore, you get the past and present associated, and you get this mechanism called experience. So if you think you're very real to somebody, see how much this person counts on experience in order to render his decisions. If a person counts a great deal upon experience to live, you can be sure that nobody else is very real to him. Sounds odd, it sounds circuitous, and yet this is just this datum of comparable magnitude. The only datum of comparable magnitude to himself is yesterday's self. So he uses this for evaluation up and down the track. Now get this idea of the only oneness of problems or situations. When a person is no longer pronouncing the evaluation of things in some grand and kingly style, when he has surrendered this in order to have a more intricate and involved game, he then needs two data. And we get one of the pre-logics, the most important of the pre-logics, is the datum requires a datum of comparable magnitude in order to be evaluated. We get the whole idea of comparison. Thus, God's invention of cannot stand singly and still be understood. People would not get the idea that God was big, or God was small, or God was powerful, or God was weak, or God was anything, unless we had invented at the same time to compare with the only God, another God called the devil. And now to go around and tell people that there's only one God, like the Muslim down in the Middle East, there's only one God, and his name is Allah Akbar, or Muhammad Mud or something. Then come up at once and say, here is another God, but there is only one God. We get why people get stuck in religion. But we know that God is good and God is powerful because Satan is bad and Satan is powerful. So we have different gods with a slight difference of intention. But we can understand a good God by understanding that there's a lot of evil in the world, and this is all done by the devil. The whole idea of sin is necessary to a good religious outlook. You must have a surpassingly excellent experience of sin before you can conceive with great fervor a fine religious outlook. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to criticize the ladies of Kansas, but I'm afraid it's true. For instance, nobody makes as good a saint as a thoroughgoing sinner. These make wonderful saints. We take in the field of writing, we take Dostoevsky. We know well the works of Dostoevsky and the Brothers Karamazov, The Idiot, other such light fiction. But we're not aware of his more serious activities conducted in the later part of his life. The later days of Dostoevsky were spent in writing overpoweringly reformatory religious books, which were all in favor of the church, just as his early books were entirely destructive of it. It's quite amusing, where he was being the devil for years, and he became God. And about the same order of magnitude, except by that time his pen slipped often enough to make the writing rather illegible. At least it must have been illegible. It's pretty bad. And his gift of writing slipped as soon as he went into the other side of the dichotomy. All right. There's many a prostitute. This looks dandy up there with a halo around her head. I'm sure you'll that. Requires a certain amount of experience of evil to experience good. Now, similarly, it requires a certain amount of experience of goodness in order to experience evil. And we get some people who were around telling us how bad it all is, how bad it all is, how bad it is over there and over here and so forth, as people who had experienced a great deal of kindness. This is a great oddity. It's a great oddity. You should look it over. So much so that only an area such as the Dear Souls area on the track could ever manufacture as many criminals as it did. And thorough education in sweetness and love, as taught in the Dear Souls area, lies behind Jesse James and Petty Boy Floyd and Jack the Ripper and Eisenhower and all kinds of people. You get the idea? It took this tremendously overwhelming idea of good to be able to produce this great idea of evil. It's quite remarkable. But these are order of magnitude. When you look at somebody who is telling you how bad it is over there, one of the ways to ruin this person, and this is where Christianity totally where Christianity got its idea of turn the other cheek, and this is turn the other cheek right across the boards, all you have to do is re-stimulate the early goodness to cause them to slip into the consequences of the later evil. You see, first and second postulate situation. You re-stimulate the first postulate, you get the second postulate every time. So just tell them how good they are and watch them collapse. The mechanism is not turn the other cheek. You must tell them how good they are, how generous they are, how nice they are, how decent they are, and how much you appreciate them. Just with malice, aforethought. Now, you say this sometimes. Most any time that you would say this, really, you would mean it. Somebody is being decent, and you tell him so, he's being real decent. But supposing somebody were just being filthy mean, somebody just being just completely nauseous, and we compliment him on his good heart, his kind intentions, his love of his fellow man. And watching Chucky's boots, he's liable to fold right up in front of him. It's a very insidious mechanism until it wears out. You could re-stimulate such a thing into being until it collapsed and was no longer a button. You play on the pianoforte of the human anatomy enough, and you no longer get strikes from certain keys. You wear them out. Human beings have to invent new keys to be pushed quite often. They are not totally enduring. So we get good and evil. But what are they but magnitudes of experience? One is constructive, one is destructive. Oh, yes, this is perfectly true. But how do we consider that something is constructive, that something is built, without understanding at the same time that it can be torn down? If one constructed something, he would expect to take it apart in order to render it not. Now, that is not native to a Thetan. That is creativeness and destructiveness, which is to say creativeness and no creativeness, plotted on the same scale as a Thetan. The original on this would simply be, it is. It is. It isn't. This would be the final word. It just would be the 1-2. We get this 1-2 rather chronic. Now, we understand things when we are no longer evaluating by postulate, but when we are being polite and evaluating by proof, by demonstration, we no longer are able to accept in only one thing. And this is a bad thing because a Thetan is to a marked degree an only one creature. And it re-stimulates his own beingness. It could be said that anything that is wrong with a Thetan is what a Thetan is. Now, when he falls into the lower harmonics of his own beingness, he comes to grief. It's quite a remarkable mechanism. For instance, nothing would be more horrible than to have a body that would survive forever, and to have every pain it had survive forever, and to have every ill it had survive forever, and have every triumph it ever involved itself in survive forever. But a Thetan is surviving forever. All you've got to do is exaggerate being a Thetan in any of its facets, and you're in trouble. Now, that doesn't say that you cannot attain these things. I said the lower harmonics. How do they get to be lower harmonics? By fixations. By fixations. On various incidents, on various circumstances, and certainly on things which exist as only one. There's nothing else like it, so you can never look away if you want to look at such a thing. You have to look at it. And this becomes very bad. Very, very, very bad. It's very bad. As a matter of fact, it becomes very amusing when you have problems of comparable magnitude. Very amusing. Because a person is using, while he runs this, his desire for evaluation, but he's putting evaluation on a cause basis. And you are running one of the highest logics in logic. Straight out of the bank. So a person doesn't have to have a beautiful sunshine in the streets in order to have a beautiful day. You understand that? A person to marked degree ceases to be dependent upon his environment to give him pleasure or pain. If you're totally dependent upon the meteorological office of the Air Force, which I think that's now called the Air, it's not the Air Corps, the Air Force? Is the Air Force? I don't know. It's the Air something. Somebody's given them the Air something. Anyhow, they own all the weather now. Some organization sits down here. It got one of the outer desks there at the Army headquarters. The Navy has the other one. And they own the meteorological department, which owns all the weather. And to be dependent on these people to turn on sunshine or turn on rain so that you can feel glad or sad rather limits your experience and fixes it. So that you do not have to feel bad simply because it is a bad day. You do not have to feel good simply because it's a good day. You know, that's an awful imposition. I have often awakened after an horrible night of sad carouse or something of the sort, carousing by sitting around talking about philosophy and running out all your happiness or something. and found the day just gorgeous, you know, just beautiful. The birds singing and the sunlight streaming down. So I was never so offended in my life. Offensive experience. I remember one night, one morning coming home about 9 o'clock in the morning in New York City. And I was going back to my rabbit warren in the Greenwich Village. And everybody was going to work or just gone to work. It was one of these gorgeous days. I was never so assaulted in my life. How busy they looked, how fresh, how unworn, how hideous. Well, I hadn't had any processing. Anyway, here we have a person being an effect as opposed to a person being able to be caused or to create an effect. And the creation of effect depends to a very marked degree upon being able to postulate an evaluation. You must say it is something or other. If you stand around and wait for something else to decide it is something or other, you're in bad trouble. Now, children do this to such a marked degree that they don't even know how much pain is painful until they ask Mama or ask Papa. They have to be told what is important and what isn't important. They sit around to such a degree and wait for people to tell them whether they're glad or sad that it's quite remarkable to get somebody in the vicinity of a rather impressionable child who's gloomy or who has very aberrated ideas, because the child picks them up at once and becomes completely discombobulated, becomes unable to tell whether food is good or bad. Child is dependent on an exterior evaluation. And I have seen a child go so far as not to eat ice cream. Why? Ice cream's bad. I don't like ice cream. I said, what? And then I, pretty fast in my feet, a snotter says, who told you that? Oh? Well, who told you that? Where? I said, ice cream's good. Horrible thing to do. I ran out the other person's magic spell and ran on in. Kids straight wire rather fast. You can straighten out almost anything with a child if you straight wire them. Thus, we look over the situation and find out that an individual is made to suffer by life to the degree that he is made to by life. Thus, his evaluation of life from himself as cause point, as an ability, is necessary to his recovery. And we find this under problems of common magnitude. The other reason problems of common magnitude works so well and easily, we could go off and discuss the whole subject of logic, you realize, the second we say comparable magnitude. I'm going to point your attention to the prelogics of Dianetics, by the way. I'm going to ask you to read those. The individual puts certain things on automatic, which is to say, he will not take certain responsibilities for one side of a dichotomy. He abandons responsibility for one or the other side of a dichotomy. And that is what we mean by putting something on automatic. In other words, it's the abandonment of responsibility to the other side of any dichotomy. Now, good and evil. He abandons all responsibility for evil. He says, I am good. Man is evil. I won't have anything to do with man. It's an interesting state of affairs because he becomes incapable of handling evil. And then goes on this 1-2 basis of stimulus response that in his next life he's going to be totally evil. If he didn't take any responsibility for it, it's going to eat him up. If you take enough responsibility for a lion, you'll dine on him. Every time. There's an interesting experiment that you can perform yourself. I advise you that you should perform this to have an understanding of responsibility and automaticity, because automaticity and ability is nowhere more necessary to understand than in problems of comparable magnitude. And that is this. Get the idea of the effort it took to make that wall. That's not therapeutic. That's just an experimental thing. Get the idea of the effort it took to make that wall. Get the idea of anything in the line of effort and emotion. And feel almost at once the overwhelming irresponsibility concerning it. It can be an irresponsibility so great that it'll make you practically ill. If you wanted to be real mean to a preacher, not improving particularly, but certainly haul him around, maw him around, change his condition, stamp on him, you could just ask him, give me an idea of the effort necessary to make your case. He'd be sitting right there in a total irresponsibility for his case. His case is there. He's not responsible for it in any way, you see. Now, how do you recover his responsibility for anything? He has to be able to confront it and view it and be it. He has to be able to handle it. It can't be over here on automatic, something for which he has no responsibility. Now, you can put something on automatic, but usually when you do, you will sooner or later get into an irresponsibility for it, because that's what automatic is. And this feeling of weakness with regard to the thing is liable to be re-stimulated. So we put something on automatic. Well, if we put problems on automatic, then we ourselves become a problem eventually without our consent. In other words, we put problems on automatic. Then we ourselves become solution. And when we ourselves are nothing but solution, and the whole world around us is nothing but problem, and we're obsessively solution, and all the problems are automatic, we wind down faster than any other method I know. We'll wind up being a problem, that is all. A lot of people are walking around, sick people who are simply a solution to what? Mother's nagging. The whole service facsimile can be summed up by just this one word, solution. Service facsimile is a solution. That's all. A person's a walking solution. How would you get him out of this? Well, he must have taken the problem for which that service facsimile was a solution and put that problem on automatic. So therefore, it would be up to you to take over the automaticity, which is to say, make the preclear do it. Take over the automaticity of problems. And if you took over this automaticity of problems, the individual then could recover from his service facsimile. But remember that you had better run terminals, not condition. Service facsimile is too often a terminal. But let us say that the service facsimile had to do with a leg, then a problem of comparable magnitude to a leg or two legs would take over the automaticity of problems which were created for legs, and so would abolish the service facsimile. And we directly run out the service facsimile. And what I've just been talking to you about solves in toto all of that that we were going over in 1952 concerning service facsimiles. And that is quite a mouthful. If you do it this way, if you know how to do it, if you can look over this whole thing and quickly see how it is done and why it is done and get it set and settled and adjusted in your own mind so you know what's going on with the preclear, then you'll be able to handle chronic somatics directly. You will be able to handle any dynamic directly. And I think that's enough for one lecture. Thank you.